Hello and welcome to the Swim Brief. I am Chris DeSantis, and today I'm joined by, gosh, a man with too many titles to introduce him with, the head coach of Cascade Swim Club, founder of Swim Swam, host of the Swim Brief. Sorry, I'm the host of the Swim Brief. You're the host of the Swim Swam podcast. Am I missing anything, Garrett?
Father, friend, brother, son. Sure. I mean, we could go on, but no, I think you got most of the relevant ones for the audience here.
Yeah. Garrett McCaffrey, who, a frequent listener of this podcast said, why don't you have Garrett on your podcast more? And I said, because I don't ask him to come on my podcast. And then as a result of that, you know, because it was front of mind, I very passive aggressively asked you to come on the podcast and you went, are you asking me to come on the podcast? And didn't answer me. And then I had to circle back a whole nother week and be like, hey, will you actually come on? I had to ask you directly. And here we are.
Well, here we are. I had to make sure that you understand, like all of us in this universe, we try to teach others lessons. And your lesson was that you have to work for it and ask like a big boy, but you did. And it is the hardest part of a podcast, right? Is like finding guests and booking them and like scheduling it and having it planned out in advance and trying to make it relevant. I don't know how this one's relevant for timeliness other than the fact that you just visited and helped out our club. But, you know, it's one of the challenges. So I understand your pain, but I also needed you to understand your pain.
Yeah, we had a conversation about that when I was out there about the booking, like people. Just to give people a peek behind the podcast curtain, we both agreed that the hardest part of trying to host a podcast is just booking people for a podcast. And it's not even that hard. It's just like on a technical level, it's almost like on an emotional level, just having to like reach out and be, and I don't know, and open yourself up and be vulnerable to people telling you no, although that hardly ever happens probably to you.
Is it like college recruiting?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, you know what I always said about college recruiting, and maybe we'll talk about that for a second. I always thought college recruiting was something that when I was thinking about doing it, I was filled with dread. And then while I was doing it, I was like, this is actually pretty fun. You know, but every time I thought like, oh, I have to do a recruiting phone call tonight, I was dreading it. I think I can say that now 10 years in the past. Anybody who might know that I recruited them, they won't take it personally. But then like, you know, when I had people on campus or I had somebody on the phone, I was generally having a pretty good time. And I think the same thing about the podcast is like inviting somebody on fills me with dread. Having them actually on the podcast, having you here, like, this is quite exciting. This is nice.
Yeah, it is nice, isn't it?
And I need a Swim Swam feed that just tells me when you're doing a Swim Swam podcast, because you know that's my issue with the Swim Swam podcast is I just want no offense to anybody else, even though I'm about to maybe offend everybody else. I just want to listen to you on that podcast, because I think you do a really nice job when you host Swim Swam podcast. It's my flavor.
I appreciate it. And I struggle with exactly what you're talking about with the booking and coming up with relevant stuff and it's one thing that, you know, being the head coach of a club that has definitely been a big transition and a different type of system than the one I was used to in Phoenix and all that stuff. But, you know, like, also getting a dog was a really dumb decision and has hurt my chances of booking podcast guests. So I haven't been doing it as much as I'd like to, but when I do get the chance and I do get that fire under my butt to get up and like get them on, I really do enjoy it. And if only there was money to be made in this industry, I could do it full time, but let's be honest, there's not.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that for a second, because as we were doing our pre-conversation, getting ready to do this. I mean, for people who are becoming aware of us being friends for the first time, you know, probably the culminating place where we became friends, I would say, was when we were both accredited media at the 2008 Olympic trials. And we got an Olympic trials coming up this summer. And, you know, I think that 2008 trials, that was really kind of the dawn of the modern Olympic trials, right? That there was a, there was that weird year where everybody went to Long Beach. Pretty much before that, it was the Indianapolis show. Now it's back in Indianapolis. It's kind of leveling up to a whole nother level. I don't want to get into like trials predictions and what you think is going to happen vis-a-vis the Olympic team, but just if you look at from 2008 to now and the way that the sport is covered, what do you think has changed, and what do you think it just seems like is immovable and won't change about the way swimming's covered?
I think definitely there's more restrictions on what you can do, where you can ask. I mean, it was like this in 2008, where we were kind of at the end of the line as far as the order of interviews, where it was the NBC broadcast, local television, newspapers, everybody else, then, you know, the internet. So we kind of got last picking. I think it's even harder now. I do think that there's a little bit longer of a line, and it's when I did a little bit in 2016, I think I did a little bit with Coleman. It was tough. It was just a different environment. Like I wasn't in the, I guess, rhythm of it as much, but I do think that there's a little bit more restriction. And, you know, when we were there in 2008, 2007 was like the wild, wild west, when the people that USA Swimming's pro-ams at that point, they were Grand Prix, or I can't remember what they were called, didn't know what the rules were about recording interviews or races, because nobody really did it. The internet was not, you know, one of the outlets that they were concerned with. And now everybody's got rights and you can do it, but only in a certain spot and only at a certain time and only with certain, you know, I guess, parameters around it, whatever. So I think it's gotten a little bit more restricted in that way. And it's a little tougher to get kind of just the real authentic version of things. Like, we could kind of just take a little camera and do back in 2008. So yeah, I think that that's it. And I also think that it's just such a moneymaker. The transition between 2004 to 2008 was the idea that we're going to get, you know, thousands of kids and make this big swim meet, and then also get their parents to pay for 8 days of tickets and hotels and all of that stuff. You know, I think it was ambitious to book a football stadium for trials. I think, you know, we don't have that Michael Phelps draw right now, and it's going to be interesting to see, you know, how they fill that thing. But yeah, I 2008 was an experience and one of the greatest sporting events. And I got to go to the Olympics that year, but I enjoyed trials more so because I had more access and was just kind of in the heat of it. No pun intended, but there was literally fire during the 400 IM. It was pretty sweet, and stuff that you just had never seen at a swim meet, and maybe even stuff that you might not see again, because I think people complained about it being too hot and the kids in the water could feel it, or the athletes in the water could feel it. So yeah, I don't know if I'm really answering your question. I think on the media side, there's a lot more restrictions. And then on, just the USA Swimming profitability side, I think that it's trying to make a good amount of money off of, you know, a big swim meet.
Yeah, I guess I look at it, and I'm thinking about this as you're talking about it, all the restrictions. One of the things that seems different to me that I've noticed is when, and like, we're referencing back to flow swimming, and I think, you know, all credit to you, like, you were flow swimming when it existed in those days. And I do think, like, you were right, it was the wild, wild west, and you were going to meets and just, you know, flipping up a camera and like going back to, you know, the Motel 8 and uploading, you know, footage of meets and stuff, and getting a lot of pushback on what you were doing. And I've watched now, it seems like belatedly, like, USA Swimming is kind of looking to notice people that are maybe drawing interest to the sport or doing a good job sort of generating excitement around the sport and trying to bring them in house, right? You and I have talked a bunch about Kyle Sockwell. You know, USA Swimming, it feels like a different era because USA Swimming, instead of being like, hey, who's this guy who's, you know, doing something without our permission, they're seeking to bring him in, right? I'm thinking also Cody Miller, the breaststroker, right? They're like trying to bring him in to the fold. So there seems to be a little bit more of an effort, even as things are more restrictive, to kind of like look at who's doing stuff. And I wish that had been there at that time, because I still, like, when I tune into a pro series meet, I'm like, we're watching like a fixed camera angle and the PA announcer is off the back announcing this meet. Like, we know how to do this better, but we're just not doing it.
Yeah. Well, it's hard. It takes a lot of like effort and energy to, you know, if you're talking about the interview and go around and get work outside of it, I mean, that's a lot of travel. That's living out of a suitcase, which was kind of the, you know, the lifestyle with Flo, which was very fun for a while in my mid-20s and then started to wear on me. And then if
life we're talking
about, yeah. And then if we're talking about like recording meets, it is just, it's repetitive and exhausting. And I mean, there's fun meets, you know, where there's, you know, like we did two meets together with Flo. We did Easterns where we just sat with one camera and I had gotten to a point where I could record races and move a camera and talk. And yeah, you kind of helped me out and talked with me, and it was fun and some of the best back and forth. And I think it was enough understanding of swimming and enough understanding of the teams to be able to be interesting for any viewer. And we were able to, you know, focus for about a 3-hour time stretch, maybe less than that even for Easterns. And it was, you know, entertaining and good and fun to do. And there was a system that was kind of usable, but it wasn't, I mean, you talk about a static camera, it wasn't that much better. We were still from afar and just kind of moving yeah, it like this. So,
right.
And then, you compare that to what we tried to do at Masters Nationals one year, where we tried to record every single race at a 3-day, 4-day meet outside in Clovis where it was hot. And we had two different pools to cover and you had to record and do the names and the play by play for every single race for, I mean, what, 8-hour days up there, 3 days in a row. And
I've started exaggerating that it's longer and longer every year. So now I say it's 12-hour days. It probably was 8-hour days, but I mean, just thinking 12 hours in the sun baking.
You get to a certain point, it doesn't really matter 12 or 8, but whatever. Right. And it just, it's miserable and nobody wants to do it. And you can't get paid enough to do that kind of thing. But if you want, I mean, it's like the podcast. If you're consistent with it and the audience can bank on it, you're going to get some consistent viewership. If you're consistent with recording races and can do it all the time and do it well, then you're going to get a decent audience. But I still don't know that there's like enough to really attract mainstream sports fans. I mean, let's just be real about this. Like, any podcast that is good around the swimming world is banking on coaches to listen. Because yeah, I don't think, I mean, athletes kind of come and go, and maybe some of them are interested enough to listen to, you know, coaches talk for an hour or an athlete talk. I don't think they're interested to listen to Caleb Dressel talk for an hour. I don't think they're interested more than like 5-10 minutes. I don't think the athletes today would necessarily be interested in it to that length, but coaches are. And I think that's what was really successful with me and Flo, was that I didn't really understand it at the time, but I was asking questions like a coach. I think that I was speaking to coaches, and that's kind of what captured interest. And I think it was so new and fresh that it was, it had a little bit of that. I mean, obviously the platform and Flow Sports has gone on to become a $1 million company, and they've kind of done their own broadcasting of a lot of different sports. They haven't really found a hold in swimming, but their platform was what made it possible in an era that, you know, nobody knew what to do with that kind of stuff. It was very cutting edge as far as the technology and stuff, but I was just out there asking questions that the core audience for swimming, which is coaches, were interested in. And so I just don't know if we're ever going to be a sport that attracts interest outside of that core audience. And so I
think you're dead right about coaches being the audience for it. And that's why, I mean, the people who still remember that you were doing it, they're almost, in my life, they're almost unanimously coaches who will be like, oh man, I remember flow swimming. That was awesome. Like those, the 99% of those people are
they're coaches. Either,
maybe if you were an athlete, we covered a meet that you were at, you remember that, right? You know, but other than that, like, especially the consumers of all the workout videos. And I tell you where I was thinking about, and I think I totally agree with your analysis. It's one of the reasons why I like listening to you do interviews on the Swim Slam podcast, because you ask the question that I would want to ask of the coaches that you bring on. Like, you're asking the coach's question, right? You're a great stand-in for a coach that's listening to that piece of it. And that is kind of the essence of what made some of those workout videos great. I was at a clinic just about a month ago, the clinic down in Gulf, and I was listening to USA Swimming present, and you know, they've just redubbed all of their educational stuff that you can go watch on USA Swimming's website, USA Swimming University. And I was listening to MJ Truex from USA Swimming present it, and she was like, and you know, I know we've designed everything on here with your attention span in mind. We know you want videos that are, you know, 1 to 2 minutes in length that you can just like watch, you know, bite size at a time going through stuff. And I'm thinking in my mind, no, that's not what I want. I want Garrett on the pool deck for 30 minutes, like talking to somebody, oh, what workout are you going to do today? Explain to me how you planned all of this out. Then I want to watch the people do it, like see what's happening. And then I want the after report. And that takes time. Like, yeah. And I even, I feel like an idiot, because at the time when we were doing stuff together, I was like, oh, these videos are so long. Like, I don't want to sit here through all of them. And now I feel horrible because you can't watch them anymore. They're just like lost to the universe, and I want to. So I was a spoiled brat at the time. But I wonder, this is the part I wonder about with that, because I would love to just suggest to USA Swimming, I'd love to tell them, hey, you're wrong. People may tell you they have short attention spans, and maybe the feedback you're getting, but like what would actually make a difference in terms of education would be some longer form stuff. But my big caveat to that is I do think flow swimming also existed at a time when there was more of like an internet monoculture. You know, there were only a few places. Like, first off, social media wasn't even big in those days. So it was like an era when you would still just load up a website. You'd be like, I want to go see what's on flow swimming today. You wouldn't rely on other websites to direct your traffic there. So I wonder if maybe that was just a moment in time that's what we can't replicate ever.
Yeah, I do think it was the wild, wild west. That's for sure. And I mean, isn't that what life is, man? We talk about that in a whole bunch of different areas that I was thinking we might get to today. But it is. It's all about kind of a timing thing where everything kind of comes together in a unique way. I don't know. I mean, those videos, I still tried to make a point. I was coming out of a broadcast mindset where things were like 30 seconds. So those videos weren't more than like 5 or 6 minutes most of the time. If it went above 6 minutes, it was
okay.
Really long one. But I think it was kind of cutting right to the stuff that I was interested in and the stuff that coaches are interested in. And I don't know. I mean, here's the problem, listener, is that Chris and I will discuss multiple topics, but there will be no concrete information that you can take away as answers, because we're not bullshitters. And the truth of the matter is there are no simple answers that you can get in 1 to 2 minutes, even though we all like to find that as like our retweets and our, you know, motivational posters. Yeah. We all think that those answers are the way. And I am as guilty as anybody of reading all of the, you know, growth mindset, you know, do hard things, you know, the power of change type of books. I think that you can find little pieces, but there are no like solid answers. It's all about like applying things in your situation. And, you know, when things really take off, it's just kind of a matter of like luck and everything kind of lining up, and it's, or whatever you want to call it. And so, yeah, I feel like figuring out exactly what could make money for Swim. I mean, you got to give credit to Mel because what he's done with Swim Swam and Braden too, because Braden's a machine and just kind of like takes content from everywhere and puts it out there. And for the most part, I think is pretty like balanced in what he tries to put out there, despite the fact that a lot of people think he has biases and stuff. I mean, it's impossible to put the amount of news out that he does and not piss people off in certain ways. But what they've done to kind of make it, you know, a working wage for full-time employees, and Braden still does other stuff too, but it's amazing how much they've hustled. But it's not like, you know, they're running off into the Google territory as far as making money and stuff. So I just think the consistency is the first thing that people need. And then just some luck of kind of right place, right time, right people. And that's kind of how I think the information comes together. And I see USA Swimming trying certain things. I guess I don't see how they're helping Kyle. And other than, you know, and USA Swimming at certain points tried to bring me into the fold with, you know, offer, you know, figuring out a way that I could be part of their network and stuff. And I imagine it would have been similar to Swimming World, where it would have been put into a box and told, you know, this is how I want you to do everything, and not really had the same freedom that I did with Flow. But I think they are always trying to be at the cutting edge of anything that people are getting attention towards, because they want to, you know, have a piece of all of that. But I don't know that they're any more friendly about it than anybody else. So I don't know though. You know, I've stopped trying to come up with the concrete answers and paths and stuff. And you're one that told my whole team about it when you came out and visited. I mean, there is no like, here's the way, follow this guide, boom, here you go, for anything in life. And that includes swimming media. So, you know, and that includes also education for coaches and how to reach them.
Yeah. I mean, you're catching me at a sensitive time. What you just said was very cathartic, because I'm just coming off of getting feedback from a team that I worked with last season, where the feedback was, yeah, they wanted you to give more definite answers. And especially when you started off without that, like you just sort of lost people along the way. And that was really hard for me to hear, because, you know, as you say, like I am kind of passionate about not being full of shit. And that does prevent me from, in certain instances, being very definitive and prescriptive about what to do. So I'm wrestling with that a little bit now. But let's talk a bit about, because as you mentioned, I've just been out to Seattle, and you know, it was great to see you. I actually had a lot of to do socially when I was out there, so maybe I'll be making another trip sooner rather than later. When you communicated to your team after I came out there, because I remember, I'm going to just ask you this live on air, because we talked about it, but I never heard about what it was. When you communicated with them after, because I spoke to four groups on the team, a couple of groups of swimmers, your coaches, and then the parents of kids on your team. What did you tell them afterwards?
My summary was kind of going over some of the points that you had just put together. At first I asked them, you know, and I really only followed up with the group of that I coach consistently, and I asked them some of the things that they took away. And I think one of the pieces was overthinking, and how there's no such thing was one of the things they definitely took away. How, you know, being disappointed is something that they're going to have to, you know, make sure that they understand. Here's the kind of the rundown. We talked about happiness, you know, where pleasure is a simple dopamine hit that won't last, but satisfaction is a state of being that comes from delayed gratification. You know, there's no happiness without sadness. And you talked a lot about how disappointment is a super fuel. And you know, that's our sport is the delayed gratification that comes with, you know, improvement after not seeing it for a while. That is the lesson that is at the core of it. And sometimes gets ruined by, you know, kids who want to see improvements every time, parents who want to see improvements every time. I was reading some comments on this whole Aaron Shackle transfer thing and how maybe he has some parents who have like jumped around with some coaches and stuff like that. And we'll see. I have no idea. I don't know who he is or what's going on. Obviously he's pretty loyal to Carmel, but you know, that was something that rings true to you. Everybody who's ever coached club knows those parents that if things don't go well, they're going to jump and go find something else. And you know, those kids are never really going to understand the whole delayed gratification thing. So I really appreciated you talking to my parents about that.
Can I just interject on that? I think this is one of the things we talked earlier about, some of the changes in the sport of swimming. This is one of the ways in which, you know, I think the assumption is always because there's more money involved in like football or basketball, you just go like, yeah, wouldn't it be better if there was more money involved in swimming? And I'm not saying like, I would love for all my coaching friends to earn a better living. I mean, I would love it as somebody who has tried to earn a living being a coach, for that to be the case. So don't take any of what I'm about to say as an argument against a little bit more financial security in the sport of swimming. But I do see this changing. And it's one of the reasons why I don't want to see it change, because one of the things that I love about the sport of swimming is I think ultimately the people who are really dedicated, they get the delayed gratification part of it. And they're cool people to be around. Like the people who figure that out, like, those are my people. Those are the people that I want to, spend time in. And I sometimes I worry that is, changing. So I'm trying to do my part to educate people about what it means to be happy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, what you kind of led with. It's not, you know, rainbows and unicorns. It's satisfaction that comes from a journey of disappointment and delayed gratification. And our goal should not be necessarily happiness. It should be satisfaction. And I could get into unless you want to be great, because, you know, we all learn from Michael Jordan that in order to be great, you would do anything and give up anything. And in order to be really great, you have to give up satisfaction because you'll never be there. To be great, you have to be crazy enough to agree that you will never be satisfied. And we could go in this. I don't want to digress into it.
Let's do it. But let's do it.
If you want to be great, then you have to give up the hope of ever being satisfied because you have to be crazy and miserable to be great. I don't know that there might be some counter, you know, to this, but I can't think of any of them. Like there's just – I take this to my own coaching and like some of the things that I've seen, and I don't think I'm ever going to be that coach that can demand the type of craziness out of my swimmers at the cost of their current mental health. Even if it could lead them to the success eventually, it's also going to do a certain amount of damage to them emotionally in order to get the kind of crazy stuff that, okay, let's just start naming names, because I think that this is something that I kind of have tried to ask Bob Bowman about a little bit. I asked him what he did with Michael that he would never do with Leon. And he said that was a good question. And I would love to just dive into this, because I think that the Bowman Michael Phelps connection is a unique duo that Bowman will never have that same kind of success, even if he had the same kind of kid, because there was just so much timing that went into that with Michael at that club and, you know, his dad situation and Bob being a young coach trying to prove himself and being so dedicated to the sport without, you know, a family of his own in that sense. And there's nothing wrong with that, but that kind of like intensity and drive and desire to be great at the cost of anything that would make you want to practice every day for 4 years, including Christmas. I mean, what kind of family things and like developmental, emotional things did a preteen and teenager Michael Phelps miss out on that is costing his, you know, family today as far as his ability to deal with his emotions? And he's working on it now, which I have so much respect. And you can see the difference in all of the work that he's done based on his whole, you know, media persona versus when he was swimming. But I just don't think Bob knew exactly what he was doing then. And now he kind of does. And there's no way he would ever treat another swimmer that way. And it takes that level of craziness to do the kind of crazy thing that Michael Phelps did. And, you know, Jordan let out the secret in The Last Dance. And I kind of realized it. It's like, you always have to have a chip on your shoulder to be that kind of great. You always have to be looking for the chip on your shoulder. And anybody you've talked to, like, I listened to Shaquille O'Neal on JJ Redick's podcast this weekend, and totally, he had to find things like to prove against people and had to be angry at somebody in order to be great. He talked about how he would always get worked by Big Country. I can't remember this center's
Grant
name.
Reeves.
He was not really like a very good NBA star. He's great in high school or in college out of Oklahoma State, but he was not necessarily any kind of Hall of Famer or even an all-star. But he would always just dominate Shaq because Shaq didn't really care about dominating him, because what did it prove? So right. Like that, there always has to be something else to motivate the kind of greatness that we all respect and we all think our kids want. It's like this absolutely endless hole of unhappiness. And in order to get there, you kind of have to. Everybody talks about there's sacrifices. You're going to have to say no to things. You're going to have to miss out on things. Coaches at the end of their career talk about how their children, you know, were great to them about missing their games and their stuff. And their wife was, you know, the thing that made it work because they just dealt with the coaching lifestyle and all that other stuff. And I mean, they don't seem happy about it. You know, they all kind of wish that they would have had more time about it. So, you know, I think we talk about, what we're talking about is a satisfaction out of understanding that maybe you're not going to be that 8-time gold medalist, 5-time Olympian, 23 total gold medal kind of athlete. You're going to be somebody who learns the lesson of delayed gratification that they can take into their work life as a professional, their family life as a professional, and hopefully maintain some level of sanity. And I don't know, I don't want to keep talking cause I always hog the mic whenever we're on the podcast together. But the other side of it is that the satisfaction comes from fulfillment in the pursuit of greatness. And if you never really have the craziness to give up the satisfaction, then you never really find the fulfillment of the greatness. And it's just kind of a weird, like cyclical journey that maybe the Europeans have figured out better than me as a American, and kind of the rat race of a system that goes around in my mind now. So you please help me. Is it better over there? But I guess, you know, the Danish are happy or satisfied, but are they, you know, are they any better off as far as happiness or better people?
Well, I'll tell you, I do think it's interesting. The flip side of the Danish satisfaction and happiness, I have so many, you touched on so many things, in your diatribe that I want to respond to, but I'll start with where you left off. And that is on the Danish piece of it. We talked about this a lot when I was coaching in Denmark, and Danish people are pretty self-aware of this, is that they love in a way that we just don't, almost can't describe it to an American audience. They love to chop people down to size. They love it. And maybe people hearing this from me will be like, oh, that's why Chris is such a bug up every successful person's ass, because he's a Dane and he loves chopping people down to size. Okay. And that may be true. You may be correct about that, but I sometimes you can see that it's a limiter. I think on, you know, especially the most great, talented people on what they can accomplish swimming wise, because it becomes such a drag over there, right? Like you get up to a very high level of something, and everybody wants to take a piece out of you, like in the whole country. And it's just not fun, right? On any level. I mean, you and I are both married. We have kids around the same age. Now your wife swam, so maybe this is a little bit different for you, but I do think, like, how many times, you know, as you continue on in swimming, does your wife just look at you and you like explain something that makes perfect sense within a swimming competitive context? And she's like, are you out of your mind? Like, what are you talking about? Right. I know, at least in my life, like, especially when we got together 17 years ago, my wife and I, like, I would just do stuff that was like, that was off. I wish I could come up with an example here in the way, I don't mean to suggest I was a Bob Bowman, far from it, but I would just do stuff that was off, and she'd be like, what's wrong with you? Like, why are you doing that? Right? Why, like, when you get out of shape, do you feel the need to punish yourself and like be so sort of self-annihilating in some situations? And I think back and I go, well, I learned that in swimming. That's what you do. Right. And so part of what I move around in the work that I do is I want people to keep the good part of swimming. I think it's possible to keep the good part of swimming that we talked about, the consistency, the hard work, the delayed gratification, you know, just the lifelong dedication to fitness and everything. I think it's possible to keep that stuff without keeping some of the crazier fringe stuff. But I have to admit, when I look at Bob Bowman and you brought him up, like, I'm super jealous. You know, there's a part of me competitively that's just really jealous. And then when I think about it for a second, I realize, like, not that this was the only reason why Bob Bowman is making 600 grand a year to coach Texas and I'm in South Jersey doing what I do, but I go, yeah, but you didn't want to do all the things that Bob did to achieve that success. Like, you didn't. You just simply, like, you, even if you had the choice, you wouldn't have. And so I'm trying to come up with, because I'm still competitive, I know I still have that competitive piece of me that's jealous. I'm trying to come up with a way that I can help athletes be competitive at the top level without risking as much harm as a lot of people have. And maybe I won't be successful in that, but I'd like to believe that there's a better way to do it.
I think there is. I'm just saying that there's not going to be a Phelpsian. You're not going to ever have somebody who goes to 5 Olympics and produces 8 gold medals at the same Olympic Games, because it's madness. I'll give some other examples. If we dive into, like, you know, Todd DeSorbo, I don't know him. I've never really even interviewed him, but he doesn't seem to have that same. But he's also never, I mean, he's got so many just unbelievably talented and successful athletes who he has developed and has continued to see improvement at these top level athletes. And, you know, I think he comes from the Braden Holloway tree, who I have interviewed and talked to, and just seems to be a lot more grounded in his balance. I don't know if that he does. I mean, I'd have to dive into it deeper. Bowman, obviously, being in the spotlight for so long and being one of the hot topics right now, you know, with his move to Texas, I think gets a lot of the attention. Or, you know, Eddie definitely, you know, had success and had some balance things that were going on too. So there might be some middle ground, but I have trouble with it. Here's my thing is, as I try to understand myself, you know, whether that is just life lessons or therapy or any of those other things, I think more and more of my process is acceptance and understanding that I have only control of myself and I cannot control other people, but our job is to, I like
influence other people.
Yeah. Right. And like, I think a lot of coaches think of like the control that they have over their athletes as their tool. And yeah. I think, you know, like I'm so jealous of Dave Durden's ability to organize the way he does and have it down to a detail, but I just can't imagine what it's like when something happens unexpectedly and goes off plan for somebody who is that meticulous about a plan. What happens when things like go out and like unexpected stuff happens? Because it has to happen. It happens to everybody. And I just wonder if that is something that like he can deal with in a healthy way. I'd like to know how. And, you know, there's just, it's fascinating to me. I just am trying to understand how that greatness can happen with a healthy relationship with success, with ego, with competition, with leadership of young athletes, with relationships.
Okay, can I ask you a question?
It's really hard to find that balance of lack of control, but also drive to be great.
Let me interrupt you with a question, and I'll answer this as well. When you were swimming, okay, was there a moment where you kind of like everything was just like on the up and up? You were just getting better and better, and you thought to yourself like, I could do this. Like I could go all the way. Like I could be an Olympian. Was there a moment like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then eventually you realized it's not there for me. And you probably kept swimming for a period after that. Right?
Yeah.
I had the same, by the way, and you were a lot closer than I was. But like mine was, and I think I even talked about this with your team when I was 14 years old, you know, like, I dropped 15 seconds in my two breaths and I went like, well, I'm just going to keep dropping time like this. And then it's, you know, 2004, Chris DeSantis in the Olympics. That's how it's going to go. And then it didn't. And I think we run into the same thing coaching wise, right? You start coaching and you're on this track and like, I don't care. I mean, who you are. Coaching wise, like your goal is you would like to coach people to the highest level competition ever and have them beat everybody. Like, don't tell me you haven't dreamed for 1 second about coaching an Olympic gold medalist or whatever. Right.
Yep.
And then, you know, maybe we still got time right on that one, but on the other hand, maybe it's never going to happen. Probably never going to happen. We have to face down that eventuality. And then it's like, okay, are you coaching because it's that goal or nothing? Or are you just coaching because you think coaching is the right thing to do? And I guess that's where I get to, right? Is that, it mirrors what I do with a lot of athletes, because I think a lot of athletes get to a point where they go like, well, if I can't be the best, why am I doing this? You go, well, there's shit. There's plenty of reasons to do this that have nothing to do with beating everybody. Like, so I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'll, open up and I don't know if he even watches anything on swimming anymore. I'm sure he might, but, my was 2004 as well. I was a walk-on at UW, lucky to be part of the team. My sophomore year, I really took off, was on like record setting relays, thought I was getting really good, went home for the summer. And there was this new coach named Sean Hutchison at King. And he really made me believe. I went and saw Michael Phelps that summer at the Santa Clara. I can't remember what the Santa Clara meet was called at that time, but maybe it was just the Santa Clara invite. Anyway, Phelps broke a world record in that pool in finals as a 17 or 18 year old. And it was just like seeing that kind of greatness and having Sean kind of like in that meet at one point say to me, you know, there's a time, you know what it's like when, you know, you're out and your buddies and like, there's some kind of trouble brewing and like, there's a fight that comes and you got to decide if you're in or you're out. And I'm like, you know, a 21 year old kid, I'm like, fuck yeah, I'm in.
Yeah.
Ready to go. And I took a year away from college swimming to train with Sean at King with high school kids. I kind of went a little like crazy, had to move home for a while, then move back with some friends. And like, it was a crazy year that ended with me not even getting Olympic trials. And then I went to Missouri and transferred, and that whole like year thinking that, you know, and I felt like Sean believed I could. And in hindsight, you know, Sean definitely was crazy. And I think we kind of knew a little bit of that then.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was a lot of, and that's what led to a lot of success and a lot of trouble. And that's the kind of fine line there. And, you know, that's why he was such an engaging personality, somebody that you wanted to buy into and believe in. And that's where, you know, it kind of went in that way. And then, you know, to speak to what you're talking about as a coach, like, I don't know that I ever really fully let go of it. You know, I still have like things in my mind. Like when I was with Sean that year, Tommy Hannon came and started training with us. And, you know, I think Sean told me that Tommy said at one point when he was watching me, like, oh, he could be a 47 or 48 was fast in the 100 backstroke back then, you know, today, if he just, you know,
yeah, 47 made NCAAs in those days, man.
Right. So anyway, like I like still have that in my head, like, yeah, I could. And it just, it never fully happened. And I do think that that's part of the fuel that got me into coaching and like definitely had me asking the right questions for coaches at, as I transitioned into, you know, journalistics, you know, side of things. And let's kind of dive all the way in. Stick with me if you can. Like
I'll always stick with you.
I knew I wanted to be involved in sports, and obviously having put so much time into swimming, when I had the choice coming out of college to either go and do local sports in small town America or dive into swimming in a deeper way, I definitely chose swimming. And I thought that being part of it in that journalistic way was going to be, you know, best for me. And I did feel fulfilled for a long time about, you know, helping the sport. Like that was the thing that I felt best about. It was not, you know, the number of views or the money or anything like that. And this was something that the Florianis, the Flow Bros, who kind of gave me the platform, did want too. They wanted to raise the bar for the sport. And I felt like we really did usher in a new like way of media for the sport. And, but after a while, I just felt like I couldn't really be part of the story like this. I could tell stories, but I wasn't making any stories like that. And that's what eventually led me into coaching. And then I got into this coaching lifestyle, which is ridiculous and crazy. You alluded to it early on with Kate, like having to be okay with taking a week or two off after your season, or I'm going to take all of August. And right. The parents who are like, well, our kids have high school coming up right after that. Like, oh my God, we have to offer practice. I'm like, well, why did you go on vacation right before our taper meet? And like, you go in that whole circle all the time. And that's where the craziness comes from, being part at the grassroots, you know, and there is no like perfect way or perfect answer. And what you're trying to do with helping out coaches like myself is trying to teach them that, and bless you for doing it. But at the same time, like, it's really hard because it's like, there's no end, right? We never get there. We're never going to get there. And that's what people want. They want the map, the path. And so now how do I get to the top of the mountain? And I just feel like you're never, even if you got there, you're never going to be like, all right, I'm there. Sweet. Like, you know, there's always going to be something beyond that. It's just like cuts in swimming. There's always something else. And so being content with the idea that even though it sucks at times and the lifestyle is hard on family and the lifestyle is hard on, you know, ego, you have to let go of it to be really great. Well, sorry, you have to have a big ego to be like Olympic great, but to be like a good person for young athletes to count on and learn from and look up to, you have to let that go and understand it's their success, not yours. And just understanding that that kind of connection can lead them into places where they could have success in life. And those ripple effects have to be the fulfillment that satisfy me at this point in my career. And I'd love to jump back into podcasting and stuff, but I think I would still, you know, have that feeling of, all right, but I'm not at the grassroots. I think coaching is as close as I can get to fulfillment of being part of those stories and really feeling like I'm helping, because you can't do it in a visit and you can't do it with a, you know, one like how to book or one technique change or one thing. It has to be part of the whole journey in order to really be part of that change. And as much as it sucks, it is my favorite part of my professional life. And definitely the part that has got me on this side of it versus the side that you know, you're on right now. So, I don't know if that at all had any kind of through line, but, yeah, greatness.
Well, I do want to, and maybe this is where we'll sort of move towards wrapping things up. You made me think your story about, Sean made me think about a couple of things. One of them, which was something I experienced when I was out in Seattle, but, first I thought, about, you know, another, as long as we're bringing up canceled swim coaches, you know, the stuff that you were referring to in terms of you want to get to a place and be like, oh, I'm here. You know, the person who really broke through with me on that was Terry McKeever. I remember I went to see her talk once and she was talking about developing team culture. And she was like, everybody wants to get to set it and forget it. You never do. You never do. It's always a work in progress. So like, and that's hard to accept, right? Because it's something that you're always pouring. You could pour endless resources into changing the culture on your team and you still wouldn't get it to be perfect, you know? But that always really resonated with me. But one of the things I got to do while I was out with you and I was thinking about, you know, the impact that some of the stuff Sean said to you had on you, I went out with a swimmer. I say a swimmer, like he's 34 years old and a full grown adult that hasn't competed in swimming in over a decade. Right. But somebody that I coached at Georgia Tech, actually one of the few athletes that I coached for all 4 years, cause I was there for 4 years. Right. So there was just a limited set of people that I was with every day, for 4 years. And, any coach, I think what I'm about to say, you know, this is true, but you probably don't think about it all the time. As he was remembering all this stuff that me and my colleagues had said that I didn't remember. And he said to me, Chris, athletes, we really remember what our coaches say to us. And you think about it, like, you know, how many coaches did you have? Like, and I don't know, in swimming, sometimes you have a lot of coaches, but really how many did you have versus any singular coach? How many people do they coach? You know, if you coach the same place long enough, you're going to get into the thousands of people. And for somebody who's had a ton of swim coaches, maybe all the way through a college swim career, we're talking about 10 people. So the athletes remember what you say to them. They do. They remember the stuff that you're trying to teach them. They probably are listening a lot more than you give them credit for. Because we as coaches, we tend to notice when they're not listening better than when they are. And so the stuff that you communicate out as a coach, it was sobering for me. It's just a reminder to me that, like, actually the things that I say are very important and I should continue to be thoughtful about them.
Yeah. And as much as I, you know, struggle with what to take from Sean and what not to, I think that belief and even just feeling like he saw me and connected with me and took the time to explain and have even that conversation, I think is a big reason that I'm still in coaching right now, which, you know, we could dive into in other ways, but I don't feel like I'm saying anything controversial with that. I do think that, you know, that connection is the reason that I am where I am as far as being a coach and being satisfied with that part of it, right? Versus I could have been a 4,700 backstroker, but I think the connection is everything. The older I get, the more you realize it's all about the relationship and the connection and the people. So, yeah.
My flip side with Sean from the flow swimming days, I say, and I wish I could find a way to faithfully recreate this, but like when I am helping people with college recruiting, which I have occasion to do just in my individual coaching, and you have somebody that is considering a bunch of different schools and inevitably they're going to have to tell somebody no. I wish for every college kid, they could get the experience of telling the coach of the school that they actually want to go to? No, because that how that coach responds in that situation is extremely, in my opinion, extremely telling about the character of the person that you're going to go to. So I, you know, I met Sean through you, and as I do, as we discussed already on this podcast, I decided
to chop him down.
Yeah, I tried to chop him down. I said, like, hey, you think you're so smart about this, and well, guess what? You're wrong, and I'm right, and let me show you. You know, I was such a snot-nosed little kid. I'm still a little bit of a snot-nosed kid. And he just tried to obliterate me, Garrett. Like, he was like, he saw red, and he was like, there was no reasonable, like, hey, whatever, like, I don't care, kid. It was like, it was some stuff. Oh, I should go back and see if I still have the emails. Of course, we argued as two gentlemen do over email. this is early internet, folks. Before we had social media, then we would have been arguing at each other on Twitter in 2024. But
totally, like, yeah, I bought into him, so I never got to see that side. Cause I was in, like, that confidence was something that we can go into my therapy and my daddy issues, but you know, that confidence is something that I definitely gravitated towards through probably my mid-30s. So, but we can talk about that in another podcast.
We'll have a whole nother podcast.
I don't know if we solved any problems, but if you take one thing away from this, coaches, don't do this. Don't do it. They are just a time suck, filthy, disgusting, needy beings that take away from your ability to be great. Don't do it.
If you're listening just to the audio version of this.
There's the shortcut. That's the one cut that really could make a difference. Don't do it. They're relentless. Don't do it.
If you're listening to the audio version, that was Garrett's dog, Jet, who is an absolute relentless person.
She thinks she's
individual.
A person.
Yes.
She thinks she's a person. She doesn't understand her role as a one-year-old dog. She is, it's her world, and we are living in it. And that's the one thing, coaches, if you're looking for some advice, don't get a puppy.
Don't get a puppy. Well, great advice. For people who want to follow along with what you're doing, you know, you're going to let us know when you get that special feed on the Swim Swam podcast.
You got it.
Maybe you're going to invite me on there. Maybe then you can ask me questions and I'll come.
I see what this is. I see. All right. And there it is.
You want to commit to that on air? All right. Great.
I think we have something to talk about now. It's going to have to be more concise than this conversation, which went everywhere. And I apologize for that. But this is like being on the phone with Chris and I some days. So
this is just Garrett and I's weekly phone conversation, but we decided to record it for you guys. So just so you know, this is what our friendship is like.
Nobody else is listening at this point, Chris. Sorry.
Otherwise, where should people follow you?
I don't know. I'm on Instagram, Garrett.McCaffrey. I'm on Twitter because I refuse to call it X. I think it's something similar like that. I don't really care if you follow me. If you want to, that's great, but I don't. I mean, most of my stuff on social is just my family stuff. So, but you can find me at Swim Swam. If you search my name, you're going to find some of those podcasts that Chris is alluding to. If you haven't already seen any of them, so I try to make it good for coaches. So, if there are one or two of you still listening, I know you're coaches, and I appreciate you sticking around for it. And yeah, there might be some more stuff on Swim Swam if you just search Garrett McCaffrey. There's some podcasts and maybe some other stuff on there.
And if you see Garrett on a pool deck, coaching Cascade, you know, go give him a shout. Just stare at him like I know that guy, but don't say anything. And then eventually walk up to him and be like, Garrett, like, and don't introduce yourself. Just roll from there.
Yeah, just expect me to know your name and then like get mad if I don't.
All right. We're wrapping this one. For me, Instagram, Christy_coach, ChristyCoach.com, swimbriefpodcast@gmail.com. If you want to contact me to get something on the podcast, you can go that route. Thank you everybody for listening, and I'll see you again soon.